interest rate for an initial period of time, like say 2 years or whatever, I don't remember exactly what the time, you know, for a few years, and then at some point that interest rate would bump up, which meant their payments would be up. So people would get into loans at a rate they could kind of afford, and then after a few years, they'd step up and step up to the point where they could no longer afford it. You know, the idea was you could get people in at this cheap rate and not worry about the future. Many of the people selling these loans, so to speak, to purchasers, to people buying houses, were turning around and paying them off to, which is to say, turning them, bundling a whole bunch of them together, turning it into an investment that you can then sell to somebody else, so that the person selling the loan, making loan to the buyer, wasn't going to be on the hook when that loan went bad.
Yeah, I think, look, there's a lot of intricate technicalities around the loan. I probably don't know as do. I think one thing that's kind of interesting to me as a social phenomenon was that in the 2000s, you had this continuation of a very long-term trend, which is population migration from the colder northeastern, kind of northern, midwestern parts of the United States toward the southwest, the Sun Belt, and Florida. And in many ways, kind of the housing stuff that was involved in the financial crisis was a combination of that. And I think one unfortunate side effect of the great financial crisis, with the housing crisis, but it paused the construction across the Southwest, the Sun Belt, and Florida. So people started getting this idea that actually the Sun Belt migration has slowed or reversed. And that is not the case. Right. I think if you look at, you know, what's happened during COVID and after, if you look at the long-term macro trends in American society, the migration to the Sun Belt is accelerating, if anything. Right. And I think this idea is that this is stopped because of the financial crisis has fed into, all, for example, the acute housing shortage in coastal cities.
Right.
And, you know, it became this kind of Manichaean kind of all-or-nothing debate, NIMBYs and so forth.
Yeah.
And when before, there was a lot of it just interregional migration. So
cool. Well, let's jump back to truthers.
So
where we, because one thing about, you know, the idea of trutherism in 9/11 is it really kicked off the idea of trutherism. It would be almost any significant event that happened, there would be a body of people promoting the idea that it didn't really happen and that it really was didn't happen the way it was presented. And that it was, in fact, a government conspiracy, a government cover-up. You know, you can take a look at the Boston bombing.
Oh, the bombing.
You know, or, you know, the Sandy Hook mass killing of children in a elementary school. And almost as soon as those events happened, people, started talking about false flags. This became a huge, word. Every time something happened, oh, no, it's really a false flag, and that meant to do something else. And Alex was a huge promoter and spreader of those kind of ideas. And of course, he got sued for his, I guess you could say, lies he was telling about the Santa Claus.
Well, they're not going to get their money. I mean, even though his InfoWars Corporation has made money over the years, but I don't think it's made that much money. I mean, it's sort of just, I don't know. But then he wiggles out of it legally, saying, well, we got this company is sovereign or is non-existent now. I don't know what he's doing.
Some sort of set of shell companies, who knows. But, I mean, 9/11 sort of happened around the same time, just after the dot-com bust, where we started to really have the emergence of internet media companies. And, and those were taking off shapes and form, the real birth of celebrity gossip news to regular news to sites that built their
and to a degree. Well, actually, Alex Jones built, like, he had the big thing. I predicted 9/11,
yeah.
Which, as I told you, it was seemingly,
yeah.
But they didn't make a bold thing. Bill Cooper was a bit more bolder about it, and then of course they had the But the conspiracy theory was created prior to the actual attack, which is a bit interesting.
But there was a period of time there, and perhaps it's still happening. It doesn't seem to be as much. Where almost any major incident like that, within hours, you could search online to find people spinning an alternative. An alternative narrative about whatever had happened, some sort of government cover-up which was meant to change opinion or, you know, influence something or hide something else.
I think the problem is looking at
If I could just add something before we're over with this. Prior to 9/11, there was the Battle of Seattle. Here in Vancouver, or the greater Vancouver area, we're in Burnaby. Yeah. There was the AIPAC protest in 1997, and in the year 2000, the world in DMC.
Right.
And one of the bad things for me, I felt about, like, the truth or stuff, is that a lot of, instead of carrying on, was being a lot of the high finance, which, you know, World Bank, IMF, and so on, everything kind of got, even that kind of got directed by way of trutherism. Like, the thing I didn't like about truthers, they would say, oh, I know about the World Bank and the IMF, but they wouldn't bring it in their focus point, you know?
I got something to say to that, because I think, in a sense, people were happy at playing, being anti-trade and anti-globalization and anti-finance while before Trump became president. And when Trump became president and brought the World Trade System into disrepair, then being anti-globalization didn't seem so cool anymore.
Right.
Because it turns out being anti-globalization actually had severe consequences. So I think that's kind of you can see this is also why part of on the left and elsewhere, the kind of the anti-finance, anti-globalization movement has faded away in recent years, because these things were always kind of, there was a little bit of play acting that as long as policymakers were united in their consensus and didn't take it too seriously, it was not that big of a deal. But when people actually started erecting tariffs and having trade wars, well, it turns out it's a little bit more complicated.
So are you a pro-globalist, Stephen?
Pro-free trade. So I'm not sure if that implies I'm pro-globalization.
No, I just meant, I mean, you're not, you know, the United Nations, World Bank, and IMF.
Well, I mean, sure, everything lumps about it. That doesn't mean we have to tear it down.
Now we're going to hear about gardening.
So. Yeah, any last words on this, Peter, before we finish up?
Well, I don't take chemtrails either. So people may think I got some affiliation with some of the stuff I've been saying last few months on the show. And so chemtrails and trutherism.
No, but I don't. So Pablo Vimas is back to talk about your gardens and what you need to be doing to be prepared for the spring. Here we go. Welcome, Pablo. Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability Society. We're in week 16, and it's a beautiful day.
Correct. The weather is warming up nicely, so yeah, we're excited to be outdoors.
Excellent. So what are you going to tell us about this week?
Coming up, the main task of gardeners are doing those days is watering.
Mm-hmm.
The rains have stopped, and now we need to start supplying water by hand or by an installation system. So today we'll be talking about watering the plants.
Great. So what do people need to think about when it comes to watering?
So when we talk about watering, we need to think about two things. One, that we like to water deep. So we need that the layers of the soil that are deep, they are the ones that contain most water.
Yep.
And the second is don't water every day, now and then. So that helps to conserve water. And as well, to prevent that the soil, all the nutrients from the soil are being washed away every day.
Great. So with the Embark gardens, you use boxes.
Correct, yeah.
Is with box gardening versus gardening at ground level?
Yes. So plants, water. So we want that the water to be as deep as possible in ground plots.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, we have boxes, and those boxes don't have water, will just infiltrate, just goes through.
Yep.
And we as well want that the layer, the bottom of the box is moist.
Mm-hmm.
Not wet, it's moist. We want, so when we forget to water 1 or 2 days, the plants still have water in the soil to withstand the heat.
Will boxes tip it out quicker than? Or I guess it just depends on the soil type. Maybe.
It depends on the material that they are made of. For instance, wooden boxes, they would tend to absorb water as well as really. Metal boxes, they just don't contain anything. The water will just go through. The same with plastic containers. Yeah.
Right.
If you are doing using pots to do gardening, so what we call container gardening, make sure that your pots are at least 8 inches tall. So a decent pot, so the bottom of that container can hold some water. The other thing that we should be aware is that, as a rule, we water the soil, not the plant, because we always are being told, go and water, and then we give up to all the plants a good shower, and we moist the leaves, we moist the stems, and sometimes the soil gets no water. So rule is, not the plants.
So how much should be people watering? You know, maybe you take a bucket out, maybe you're out there with the hose, you know? I mean, surely you can overwater.
Absolutely, yes. We can overwater. And so it depends of the size of your plot. For instance, here in Bark, we have plot 4 feet by 4 feet and 26 inches tall. So we take around 3 minutes to water that. But 3 minutes using a hose.
Excellent.
And as well, when you are watering, with a hose, in particular, we have this opportunity that we can regulate the flow. So it's not too much water, not too little, just a decent amount. So we can see when we are watering, the soil is absorbing, is infiltrating the water. So it's nothing stand.
What about different plants? I mean, do they have different needs, and where can you find out that information?
Oh yeah, so all the plants have different needs, and what I tend to do is, where is the origin of those plants? There are plants that are originally from the Mediterranean, so sage, rosemary, oregano, thyme. Mm-hmm. Those plants are okay with not having water quite often, so they are doing well. Except the English lavender, that is, is growing with climate. And then we have vegetables like lettuce, cabbages, leaf crops, more often watering. Not so much because they have storage in the roots. So, so will be a bit of Googling and see what kind of vegetable you have. The rule is that if it's a leafy, if the plant produces leaves, a bit more watering.
Excellent. So just to recap, we're watering every day, every other day or every third day?
Yes, correct. Yeah. For instance, here in Bark, we water twice a week on Tuesdays. On Fridays, because it's on campus over the weekend, we don't want to worry, everybody is busy. Yeah. So, and then we have 3 days in between. So when we come on Tuesday, we water again.
What are some quick signs that perhaps you're over or under watering?
Overwatering, you will see that the soil is constantly moist on the top of the surface. As well, you will see fruit flies growing in there because it's lots of a nice environment for the plants. Plants, the leaves will be droopy if there's too much water. Bacteria might start growing on the stems at soil level. And so the plant's not happy. Again, when you have underwatering, you will see soil is cracked, it's hard. Plants are really showing you that they are thirsty. Again, they are not green, a bright green. They are dull and droopy leaves. Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks so much. So much to consider about watering. And I guess one of the key things to keep your garden growing robustly.
Yes, as I mentioned, try to avoid watering the leaves, water the soil. And as the weather gets hotter and hotter, we need to avoid watering the leaves, because plants like tomatoes, potatoes, and beans, they don't like water on the leaves because blight will come.
Right.
And then we are fighting a disease. Don't want better to prevent.
Does time of day matter much at all?
No. If you are watering the soil, doesn't matter. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank Pablo Vimes of Embark Sustainability Society. Tell us how to find out more about Embark.
Yeah, Embark can be. You can follow us in our social media channels at Embark Sustain, EmbarkSustainability.org.
Great. Thanks so much. Pablo will be back next week. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pablo, for that. The Music Wave Vancouver's celebration of local music is coming up next month, June 6th to 9th. Here's Jamie Sessford's documentary all about music waste.
When we think of music festivals today, we still find ourselves married to this image of Woodstock. We have open fields, big stages, thousands of people probably suffering from questionable hygienic choices, booze and drugs. And to be honest, not much has changed. If anything, the idea of a music festival has been streamlined into a rite of passage for young adults. Coachella, into Sasquatch, into Sled Island, there's just so many choices. And they're all big productions and frankly aren't very cheap. But sometimes, you don't need to spend hundreds of dollars or travel hours away to see great music or party hard. Of course, if you're from Vancouver, you probably already know this. Because you have music waste. Every June, for 4 days, and 50 do is hop on your bike and around from venue to venue. That's it. That's music waste. And for Vancouver's music community, it's kind of become this unofficial kickoff to summer. But there's a lot more to it than that. Music waste comes from a true anti-establishment sentiment, born out of a sarcastic discontent with corporate music and their sponsors. There's a spirit to this festival that's rooted in his survive for 20 plus years, outliving many of the big box competitors that it was created to protest against.
For me, I think Music Waste is this Vancouver.
She's a coordinator for Music Waste.
Because the festival doesn't take itself too seriously and because it's kind of volunteer run and most of the bands are really relaxed, when stuff does go wrong or something happens with a venue or something has to shift, everybody kind of really has this can-do attitude where they're like, yep, okay, we're just gonna, that doesn't work, so who can I call in for favors? Like, and because everybody loves Music Waste, they're often very willing to help and to kind of overcome those hurdles.
And that's the big takeaway from Music Waste, the message from the community to itself. Don't take yourself too seriously. Now, when the original started in 1994, this was the idea. It was to push back against a festival that did take itself far too seriously and forced people to kind of bump elbows and pay to play. Initially, it was a one-off, but then it started to grow. After a couple years of hiatus, this festival was revisited again in the new millennium. This is Dustin Bromley. He used to be a coordinator for Music Waste.
So, as I understand it, there was New Music West, which was, very, let's say, corporation-funded, and, you know, there's a lot of your Nickelback-style bands, your rock band. Apparently their selection process was a little more, elite, or they were definitely going after a certain sound. Very, very easy on the ears. And these bands, as it's been told, were doing things that have been done, thousands of times before. But people started a one-day festival called Music Waste, which, as I mentioned, is big, big middle finger to the sky to New Music West. In subsequent years, it expanded to a multiple-day festival.
But it really wasn't until the revival in 2004 that Music Waste became the festival that we would recognize it as today. These are people that was around Music Waste at the time of its rebirth.
I was an intern at the Terminal City Weekly magazine, and the people there in particular, who was the music editor at the Terminal City at the time, and Darren Atwater, who was the editor, they sort of remembered or thought back nostalgically about Music Waste and thought they should resurrect it, and they... I believe they actually talked to Chris Wood, who was one of the original organizers. They bought it from him for 50 thing, or maybe even less, and they sort of took it over. And the first year was really successful and really fun, and to me, really sort of embodied exactly what it was meant to be, where it was sort of just chaos, and everyone was just organizing it out of the good of their hearts, and no one was really making any money.
While New Music West no longer existed, the ideals did. The idea that networking, self-promotion, and presentation were more important than the artistry behind the music was, and still is, a point of frustration within the Vancouver scene. During her time at Terminal City and then Only Magazine, Sarah and her team actively tried to disrupt superficiality through Music Waste and its promotion.
We often wrote sort of silly of the band that were not take it too seriously, and who wants to read, you know, 85 band descriptions that are all just like talking about how great so-and-so, or, you know, how they're breaking boundaries and coming up with a new sound. It just seemed more fun to kind of make up funny stuff or tell, you know, funny stories that we knew about them. We were just so sick of bands just sell themselves to us, I guess.
Now, the festival's approach to actively pushing back against industry norms wasn't necessarily shared across the local scene. Bands on Vancouver work hard to cultivate image and press kits and didn't appreciate being called out for it.
Some of them were offensive, actually. I should say that some of them were really too far and were just like vulgar and awful and rude. And some of them were maybe too sort of actually poking fun at people. Something weird happened that was sort of a protest to music waste. And I think what happened was 2005 or six, and it was at the Columbia or Mike's Tavern. But the band, the Book of Lists, were boycotting, and then for some reason at the last minute, they decided to just like hijack a show and play. So we just like got a bunch of texts that that they were setting up at the show. And I don't know, maybe they were friends with the other bands that were playing, but they like set up and played a short set. And Cam and I like biked down there as quick as we could to them. And it was like kind of great because it was, you know, they were sort of mad at us, or they were sort of doing it as a protest or something. But we thought it was really great in a prize, or to have, you know, a show sort of be sabotaged in a way that resulted in people getting to see a great band.
But this don't take yourself too seriously attitude fueled the largest criticism artistic elite.
Antagonism sort of between some bands or some artists and what they perceive as like be or elite group of people who are putting this on. But I think that's just based on a misconception that these people are being snobby or elitist, because they do have to choose a limited number of bands.
There are times that we have to make a decision and say, okay, no, this band has played quite a few years in a row, and we should give that spot to a new up-and-coming act. In the most part, I find that in the general spirit of the whole, bands are very supportive and kind of manage that themselves even.
Although Music Waste does frequently see many of the same faces, the turnover is fairly regular. During his tenure on the committee, Mark Richardson was tasked with scheduling the festival and recognized the emergence of new, younger acts.
Because Music Waste, they take a lot of chances on newer bands and younger bands. There's obviously a lot of familiar faces that you'll see from years past, but there's always try to make sure that there are new younger bands being selected each year, and that draws in their fan base or their friends. So I think if you do that year after year, you're just going to keep drawing in new people.
There was not enough infrastructure for emerging and weird local bands to sort of showcase themselves in a sustainable way. And I think that the more you support musicians, the more support you. And historically, we've tried to be as inclusive as possible and allow people to have Music Waste shows, like to put if they can find a venue and make it happen if they didn't get in. And we tried to support them with as much promotion as possible if they were willing to accept passes.
In making music more available and more accessible, Music Waste has opened the door to the community and has allowed artistic integrity to remain at the forefront of the scene rather than who you know how much money you have.
Music Waste has consistently been expensive, so the passes are $15. And that, if you think about the fact that in the past 20 years, like, everything has gotten more expensive in the world, the fact that it has remained this low price is incredibly remarkable. It's really important to everybody to keep it inexpensive, so I don't see that changing. Or at all. I don't see that changing ever. Actually, I think music waste would probably stop existing before it got more expensive.
This is the commitment music waste, but like, whatever.
And Music Waste is June 6th to 9th. It's a little more expensive now, $40. They have an event this weekend, the pre-Waste. You can check that out at Redgate this weekend.
CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The strike is for our people in the north. It feels difficult to us for every martyr and every child who falls. What is required from us is that we sympathize because the faithful are our... What happened in the north is a little thing in front of what happened in Gaza. In Gaza, there are 34,000 martyrs or more.
Palestinians across the West Bank held a genocide Sunday to protest an Israeli military aid on a raid on a refugee camp that killed at least 40 people and left the camp uninhabitable. We'll go to Ramallah for an update from Palestinian journalist Mariam Barghouti. And we'll get an update from the Gaza Solidarity Encampment University, which reached its day and has inspired solidarity encampments on campuses across the country. We'll speak with a Palestinian journalist and journalism university, as well as Columbia professor who addressed the encampment, Mahmoud Mamdani. Classes are being held remotely today.
The most striking encampment was that it was a peaceful demonstration by students, and yet it was met with building gun, threatening violence.
Then President Biden signed legislation to reauthorize Section 702 of FISA, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, despite warnings it could greatly expand the government's ability to conduct warrantless domestic surveillance.
The bill could allow the government to force ordinary U.S. businesses with access to communications equipment, like a Wi-Fi router, to give the national security to their equipment.
We'll speak to James Bamford, longtime investigative journalist, about how the NSA wants carte blanche for war.